the generation of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So this is what is mentioned in Sunni narration is that for sure he is one of the offspring of Fatima al-Zahra salamun alayha, this is for sure. But whether he is from the offspring of Imam Hassan or Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there are conflicting narrations in Sunni sources.
So the parents are alive. You mean generation after generation?
Yeah, generation after. And
the later generation?
Yeah.
Thank you, Imam Sheikh, for proving the existence of Imam al-Mahdi as the son of Imam al-Hasan al-Askari. You know, it was very kind of you. So historically speaking, according to historical facts, Imam Hassan al-Askari is the father, Najas Khatun, who is believed to be from the Roman lineage, isn't it?
According to one narration,
is the mother. And he is passing life in major occultation. There are still so many questions for the long life of the Imam. Let's shift it to the other discussion, inshallah. Thank you so much for this episode.
My pleasure.
Thank you much, dear listeners. For more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. Also send us your questions and emails to englishradio@sinarabi.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Face to Face. My name is Dieter Reinisch, and you're joining us today from the UN headquarters in Vienna. With me today is the Deputy Foreign Minister of Belarus, Igor Segreta. Igor Segreta has been here in Vienna for the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE and for a meeting with the IAEA Director General Raffaele Grossi. Mr. Segreta, you just came from a meeting with IAEA Director General Raffaele Grossi. What was the purpose of your meeting? What was on the agenda?
You know, each and every time I'm visiting Vienna, I'm looking for new contacts. I'm visiting our partners and friends. We strictly cooperate. And the agency, Atomic International Atomic Agency, is one of our key partners. It because as you might know, we created a new industry. We've built a nuclear power plant, and we did that from the start, from the decision to build the new nuclear power plant till the finishing of its and bringing it into action, into exploitation. We've been relying and we will looking for assistance of International Atomic Energy Agency, and we're very helpful for them, for their very professional and very timely assistance.
You just mentioned it, you are expanding your existing nuclear power plant. You are recently, President Lukashenko announced to build a third unit. Why did Belarus decide to put more, such a large focus on peaceful nuclear energy?
Well, it's natural. I think as soon as we see the energy consumption growing, we had to modernize our generation capacities. So we've seen the efficiency and the outcome of the nuclear power plant, modern technology, the highest level of security. You know, for Belarus, we are very vulnerable in that sense because we've had a tragedy in 1986 in Chernobyl, and Belarus was severely contaminated by the radiation after that. So for some years, we had to persuade people that peaceful and very modern and very secure atomic energy can bring substantial results for the economy. As I mentioned, the energy consumption is growing each and every year. People, the regular citizens, they buy more and more electric cars, more and more public transportation means is driven by the electricity. We started developing the mining capacities for cryptocurrency, and we're looking for the data center creation. Belarus is a developed IT country that puts a lot of attention to that sector. Well, that's why we see the trend and we follow it just.
You mentioned the constructive cooperation with the IAEA in regards to peaceful nuclear energy, but at the same time, we've witnessed in particular the last 2 years heated debates here in this building, here in Vienna, at the Board of Governors meetings, at the General Conference of the IAEA, in relation to ongoing armed conflicts around the world, both in Middle East, West Asia, and in Eastern Europe. Two of your neighboring countries, Russia and Ukraine, are at war at the moment. And there is debate on security of nuclear plants in Ukraine, also in the Kursk region. There are regular attacks in the vicinity of these nuclear plants. How do you see the role of the IAEA in these conflicts?
IAEA has the highest ever reputation in that sphere, and represents a big majority of countries that have the atomic capacities on their territory, and they know that security in that sphere is crucial. So in the ongoing conflict, I think, and you've heard that on the conference, President suggested that we should introduce a ban for the attacks on critical infrastructure objects, and we should protect them properly, and we should mobilize the support of the international community. Meaning the protection, I meant also the ban for imposing sanctions on the industries, countries that utilize the atomic energy, because that might bring to some shortages of spare parts or some technologies that are crucially sufficient and necessary for providing the security. So definitely, those capacities, atomic capacities, should be duly protected, and because the explosion on them could bring to the, could easily bring to the situation that we've had on the Chernobyl reactor in 1986 and in any other countries. And this could contaminate vast territories, big territories in Europe. So for our own security, we should do a lot and persuade the international community, and the International Atomic Agency could do a good job in that, persuading their members to refrain from attacking the NPPs.
Which is actually the statute of the IAEA, but still in June, such attacks happened. The US and Israel attacked Iranian sites, nuclear sites. In reaction to that, unfortunately, Director General Grossi refused to condemn these attacks. And at the General Conference in September, a resolution had been tabled by Russia, China, and Iran, and also supported by your country, Belarus, to refrain from these attacks. How do you see the situation now that even in the 21st century, it is still necessary to table a motion that says we are against attacks on peaceful nuclear facilities?
I think that we are still a little bit far from getting the long-standing solution for that. But I can only confirm that Belarus will support each and every effort that will bring more protection, more security, and more peace, even if there is some dispute or conflict appears. We were following attentively. I think many people, many politicians in our region and outside were worried about the situation which took place in Iran. And I think that exactly not by weapons, not by means of military forces, any obstacles, any disputes could be solved. This is the job of the international employees, international agencies, politicians and diplomats. And that's what we're interested to do. We do believe in a classical diplomacy without fakes, without assaults, attacks on each other. That's what we see now on the OEC premises in the United Nations. People sometimes blame secretariats of these organizations for not providing a proper assistance or just infrastructure or getting some events which would suit them. But, you know, I would like to draw your attention that the secretariats, they just serve the countries. And the atmosphere which is now in Vienna, in Geneva, in New York, and in other European and world capitals is just like this, like the countries are representing themselves on these sites. So we have to start, and we've talked about that with Director General of the Atomic Agency, that we do believe that politicians from countries active in that sphere, in the sphere of security, in atomic energy, in the conflict settlement, they will be more polite and they will be more constructive in discussing modern challenges.
And you just mentioned the OSCE. That was, so to say, the second purpose of your visit to Vienna, the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE that took place here in Vienna this week. And I followed the conference very closely. I listened to the speeches over the past 2 days, and listening to the speeches, the constant attacks both on Belarus and Russia from every single minister, delegate, and representative. One might wonder, why are you attending the OSCE conference in such an atmosphere?
Because we do believe in the spirit of Helsinki. We believe in the force of real classical diplomacy. We do believe in the future of this organization, which can be a very effective instrument in for the conflict settlement. That's what it has been designed for. You're absolutely right. What we see in Hofburg recent years, is just the throwing to each other the national statements. But unlike many other countries from Europe and other regions, we each and every time try to persuade our partners, try to find the solutions, try to mobilize the support, try to find the not politically biased topics that we could discuss in smaller groups, in a some formats that are not non-discriminatory for other participants. And I think what we are now lacking at the OSCE premises is the talks about the participation of Russia and security for Russia. Because what has started in Ukraine, it was the lack of security for Russia itself, with the NATO expansion, with the collapse of Soviet Union, with the collapse of the international architecture, with the collapse of that spirit of Helsinki that brought people from different countries with different views to the same table, which finalized with the final act, Helsinki Final Act in 1975. So I do believe in the power and force of diplomacy, and I hope we will shortly bring to an end to that conflict, and we will restore the trust and enhance the confidence building measures.
But as I said, listening to the speech and also following other international organizations, one becomes very pessimistic that this approach is even possible. Instead of what you said, the spirit of Helsinki 1975, the idea of closing the gap between different blocs, presenting a space for dialogue. Now we see a clear split in all international organizations, the introductions of sanctions against states, just like your state, but also other states, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and the so-called sanctions regime from the West is tightening. How you assess, in general, the Eurasian security architecture at the moment?
Well, I think that we should bring the security issues in a broader context than Europe itself. We should expand it to the whole continent, Eurasian continent. And that's what we are doing regularly in Minsk since already 3 years. The newest edition of the conference took place in October, end of October in Minsk. And every year it gathering more and more participants. We enhance the level of political participants from different countries. And we try to attract as many attention as we can, transforming this event to the unlike-minded event. We are not seeking support and looking only for our friends. We are also inviting those who will not support us, but they will understand our motivation, our efforts, and will someday they will bring some also support and income to that format. I agree with you that the situation is far from ideal, from being too peaceful, but if we stop talking, if we close the doors, we will bring the world and the region to the war, the global war, or to the full-scale war in the region. That's what we don't want to do. And our intention is not to make everyone agree with us. The intention was to make everyone understand what we mean, and we could also understand the intentions of the other side. That brings, because the war is being often starts when people don't talk to each other and they don't understand each other. This misunderstanding it enhances the level of conflict potential. Conference is a good format. You participated in that, and I think you felt the atmosphere of Minsk spirit, so to say, and we will continue. We are not substituting OSCE in any case. OSCE is an international organization where we could do the three traditional baskets, our cooperation, and the conference is the awareness building, is the spreading of information, and gaining support from countries that are worried by the problems in Eurasian security. Well, we've seen the number of participants from big Eurasia, from different countries, from different analytics reviewers and specialists in international relations. I like this atmosphere we've created, and I do believe that we will go further, because it has become an annual event in Minsk.
By strengthening Eurasian security, at the same time, when you look at the Western media, the Western politicians, they accuse Belarus of undermining European security. Very often you hear this example of using migrants to undermine Western European security. What do you say to this argument?
Well, we don't use anyone. Migrants trying to cross the border illegally via our territory because they are desperate about the situation in their countries, in their countries of origin. And they use our territory to get to a better life. But what they see on the border, they see the cruel pushbacks, they see the unwelcome approach from the authorities of the neighboring countries. They don't see any even procedures, refugees procedures or asylum seekers procedures. They don't see the, and they, are being disappointed, and we see less and less those poor people on our borders. We try to persuade our partners that we should return to the format of building shelters for those people. We should do something to improve situations in their countries of origin, and Belarus is very much engaged in that process. You've noticed probably the visits of our president, of our prime minister, of our minister of foreign affairs to Asian countries, to African countries, where we create jobs, where we supply our technologies and equipment, and that brings more trust, more confidence, and we are happy that our turnover is increasing in food and products, in machinery, and so on. So I think that the illegal migration is a problem that we could combat only together. Throwing the claims on some countries, that doesn't help to change the situation to the best. So we call upon international community and our neighbors and countries of origin of those migrants to sit and see together what could be done to improve the situation. Commenting your remarks on the Eurasian security, I would like to note that the main problem mostly lays that some parties want to win, but we all win if the war will not start. That will be the win. We should not collapse or bring some countries to collapse as they did with the Soviet Union. On the political map of Europe, each and every country today presents a guarantee that something bad will not happen, that the military conflict will not break out. You see what happened in Ukraine. That's because of lack of confidence and lack of security granted for all countries. You cannot be secured if you bring insecurity to your neighbors. So the neighborhood, we consider the neighborhood is the main asset that we have to share and we have to preserve with all our neighbors. And I mentioned that numerously on the OSCE premises. We don't want to see the NATO at our borders. We want to see Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Ukraine, and Russia. As in the sense of neighborhood, it's vital for us.
At the same time, you mentioned avoiding a war. The world is moving into a new direction towards a multipolar world. The North American domination is clearly coming to an end, but particularly the European Union is unwilling to accept it. We recently see the introduction of the Rearm Europe program, conscription in France, in Germany, building massive armies. They even talk about we need to go to war against Russia. How can a war actually be avoided?
Well, the war could be avoided with the perception that it will bring no victory to some separate countries. This will bring blood, victims, destructed infrastructure. Unfortunately, those who rearm their armies and enhance the level of militarization, they have forgotten about the pain and tragedy that war has brought to their countries. And I think that I do believe that we don't need a new war to understand that, because war is very expensive, very unpredictable, and it will and it economically it's not efficient means of solving the problems. The only efficient way, maybe long but longer than the military conflict, but longer but very stable, and will bring more profit when we sit and again discuss things instead of militarize, put money, pump money into the military and military budgets, and enhance the military industry, and enhance the army, because it's not economically necessary, and it will bring the traditional spheres of the economy to a collapse.
But at the same time, we see increasingly a move of some states to work outside the international law framework. United States, Israel, with their attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, breaking international law, and these attacks had no consequences for these countries, no consequences at the UN Security Council. How can international rule-based order re-established?
You know, the architecture, international architecture, and the rule of law has been not destroyed, but in a bad shape at the moment. I agree with you. How could we restore that? By restoring confidence, by restoring trust, by showing each other that we respect international law, which has been created by many generations before us. And we should create new mechanisms that will help to build, rebuild it, that and restore that trust and confidence. I do agree with you that the secretariats of international organizations, often monopolized by certain countries' representatives, that don't want to talk about any appeasement, any peaceful solution on different matters. And what the Security Council, as I mentioned, reflects the current state of the intergovernmental relations. So sooner or later, I believe in the force of diplomacy, we will sit and decide that, because many countries that are trying to support military operation in Ukraine, they realize that their communities are lacking something very substantial: social standards, the energy tariffs, the cost of living is not as it used to be even 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that the policymakers should realize that they are specifically designed and brought to their positions not to start the wars, but to finish and up the conflicts and to settle problems and make their best to enhance the standard of living for their population, for their communities. People are against the war, that's evident, but on the West, they are frightened, they are scared by every day's reports, information reports, saying that one country is an aggressor, somebody is their supporters, and so on. But, you know, this is today's everyday's routine, unfortunately. But I do believe that the glass is more than half full than empty. So we are doing, with our colleagues, a lot of job at the moment to find right formats and right solutions in the sphere of international relations and in our region. And the topic number one on my desk every day is the security issues, situation on the border, and relations with the neighbors.
And final question, coming back to the Third Eurasian Security Conference in Minsk, really high-profile conference. If you look at the participants, contrary to the OSCE meeting here in Vienna at the moment, we saw a personal participation of the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. We saw high-profile representation from many other countries like China, Hungary, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran. But I'm wondering how this conference and the debate and discussions at this conference can be turned into practice to strengthen Eurasian security.
it's already been transferred into a practice, because as a follow-up, we see the numerous consultations between the ministries, we see the interaction of analytical community, we continue the meetings in a smaller formats of representatives that were part of our conference. We see the articles, and we see the effects in more predictable and friendly relations between countries participating on that conference. We see new perspectives for the trade turnover and economic relations. I think that the money spent to organize that conference, we've saved a lot of resources due to that event. More and more people do believe what they saw with their own eyes and do not believe in what they read or hear every day from TV or from internet. They see how country looks like, they see how people are living, and that even enhances the diplomatic efforts that we maintain every day.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deputy Foreign Minister Igor Segreta. That's all we have time for now. Thank you for joining us from the UN headquarters, the Vienna International Center, here on Face to Face, and goodbye for now.
Scorched feathers, oh my angel, you're melting. I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of Muslim Lady. More specifically, our salam and gratitude to women listeners of our program. Well, this is Nahid having the honor of being with you on this episode, and here with me, I have the honor of being with my very dear sister, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Well, I am so glad that we have you here, and we would appreciate if we could have a brief introduction of you as a Muslim lady.
Yes, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, thank you so much for having me. Then I am Tafalan Zainab Askari. I hail from Indian Administrative Kashmir, and I've been living in Qom for some 10 years studying Islamic studies, and it's been some past 2.5 years that I've been researching specifically on women topics, and especially what are the Islamic perspectives about women, and I've also been writing about it.
Great.
For quite a time now, yeah.
Thank you, sister. Women are working. Women are having much on their plates. They are being a good mother, a good wife, and a good servant for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in some cases, women are working outside too. But let's start today's discussion by this question, that why is not working at home valued? We all have seen the samples of our mothers devoting their whole time, energy, and putting lots of effort into raising us, into taking good care of the household. And at the same time, they were a good wife, but based on the culture, based on the time that they were living in, many of them have not worked outside. But this concept of working at home has not been considered as something that much valuable. Or we used to say, like, when somebody asks us, what was your mom's job? We used to say, like, my mom is not working. Where is this coming from, that working at home is not valued? Why it is not considered as a valuable job?
Because the modern world has confused worth with wages. Right. You're valued only with the wages. It praises what is seen. It celebrates what is sold. But the work of the heart, the unseen labor of love, those emotions are usually left unpaid and unnamed. She actually teaches a language. She heals fevers. She feeds souls. But society says you're just a housewife and you're unemployed.
And the criteria of the responsibility for a woman who is in charge of home and children is much more than a simple job.
Indeed, she's not unemployed. She's a creator of a humanity. She's a creator of humanity. We have to understand this. And Islam pays a huge, attention on raising a child. For example, Islam says raising a child is a jihad.
Right.
Like we have a hadith from Prophet Muhammad. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family. Paradise lies beneath the feet of mothers.
So
motherhood has such a value. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in Risalat al-Haquq, the treatise of rights, says that the right of your mother upon you is that you know she bore you when none bears. She protected you with all her limbs, gave you her life, and preferred you over herself. I was reading a research recently. It said that, do you know why women after 30, 35 have pain in their legs? They need more calcium. They have pain in their teeth and all. Because when a child was in her womb for the 9 months, and when it was not able to get the necessary calcium or other requirements or nutrients, it used to take from the, suck that from the teeth and the bones of the mother.
Oh, exciting. So it's the matter of devotion of soul and body.
How can you repay that? So this is not a part-time labor. This is a divine, a full-time sacrifice. and yet she's not paid.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately.
And it's not considered as a job.
Yes, because her currency is dua, barakah, and the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah, so true. Now, talking about what Islam mentions, what perspectives Islam considers into this matter of the women bearing responsibilities at home, let's go for a very short break, then we'll be back, and we're going to discuss Islam's views towards women.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady. Today, we started this discussion with my very dear sister Zainab about women and their role as a person who is working at home and at the same time is considered to be, let's say, unfortunately jobless, a person who's not working and is unemployed. Now, switching to Islam's more in detailed perspective towards women's responsibility at home, let's see the way our religion introduces the women's responsibility. Can you tell us about the way Islam is defining the women's responsibility and the job that they are being in charge of?
For example, see, Islam honors choice, but also has some guidelines. For example, if a woman chooses to work outside, Islam does not have a problem with that, as long as environment is halal, it's safe,
right,
and she's not neglecting some higher responsibilities. But it's also clear that greatest rewards come from raising righteous children, supporting the family. Like, for example, When are men considered to be in jihad, in the struggle?
Right.
When they're in the battlefield, usually, right? But a woman, if she's raising a child or, you know, just taking care of her household, it's a jihad of women, right? If she's not neglecting these responsibilities, she's definitely doing a jihad, a higher struggle. Building a home that reflects Jannah is literally something that's priceless. Lady Fatima Salaam Alayha never sat in some, I would say, some companies to be remembered. It was like, still the world is, you know, world praises her and stands in awe of her.
Right.
So her value was not in the public appearance. Basically, it lies in the eternal influence. I'd say, I would like to quote Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayha, who said, I would like to quote Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi, who says that from the laps of women, great men are born. Take the example of himself.
Yeah, so true.
Do you remember his mother, like, I don't know, working in some external environment and in some multinational
exactly,
company
and
or
the way
some.
His wife was also raising the
exactly,
children.
Exactly, exactly. Because, you know, we also have these guidelines. Imam Ali Alayhi Salaam said, teach your children before others teach them. Their hearts are like empty soil. Whatever you plant will grow. This is so important. So like when a woman knows this and starts that teaching herself before someone else comes up. Because when we get engaged seriously in the outside world, where we are happily taking the low income.
Right.
And that lot of stress. We really neglect this upbringing where about Imam Ali Alayhi Salaam says that someone else will do it. And I would never see in the lap of a mother a nation is born.
Yeah,
if a mother is taking care of her child. I would like to clear myself. I'm not giving some preference of staying home than working outside, but I'm just creating some differences how we are blindly happy working outside for lower wages.
Yeah, and we're honoring that.
And how we are not honoring something that is jihad, something that is highly valuable, something that is that has no price, basically. I Marty Soleimani in one of his speeches says, there are some of the jobs in this world we do that cannot be paid by anyone.
And considering the way mom has the feelings for a child and the way they are the, let's say, most careful people regarding the way even others are looking at their child. So the solution towards this, if I want my my children's future life to be secured and safe, to be in the way that no one will bother them, or they will not bother the society as well, well, the solution is here. Though, unfortunately, in modern society, we might fall into the trap of calling this this situation, the situation of a woman who is unemployed. We have the higher degree of a job here. And what it takes is the deeper thought, right? It takes the deeper thought into the definition of the way a woman is working at home.
Right.
Considering women's great responsibility at home and the way that this modern society sometimes disregards them, let's imagine that we are not going to value women's responsibility anymore, and we are not going to, like, this position, the position of motherhood, is not going to be considered worthy or valuable. What will happen here in this chaotic situation that mothers, the definitions of life are not going to be considered valuable in the job that they are doing, the responsibility they are bearing? What will happen in this situation?
Be very careful of the situation, because consciously or unconsciously, you are developing a silent grief within her. A silent grief grows in our homes. Like, mothers feel unseen, the housewives feel ashamed, the children feel neglected, because the first nurturer is being told, you're not enough. And society, it raises broken adults, chasing worth in screens, not in the souls. So I would say no one says thank you to her. There are no medals, there's no promotion, there are no salaries, just dishes, diapers, and deadlines. And definitely there's this phrase also, someone saying, you're lucky you don't have to work.
Right.
So this is so unfortunate. The Prophet, peace be upon him, when the Prophet, peace be upon him and his purified family, whenever he would enter his home, he would help with the chores of the home. He did not ask, what did you do all the day? He asked, how can I serve you?
Right.
How can I help you?
And what is sometimes forgotten is that when we look at mothers, since they have this great character of devotion, of caring and kindness, we consider them as not normal human beings, like a woman. She is still a woman with all her feelings, with all her needs and wants, but she's sacrificing everything for the sake of a family. She's shaping a family by paying the price of her youth, her energy, and all the effort that she can put in life.
Yes, I would say we should remember this, that always, always remember this. A woman's heart breaks not from exhaustion. She did all that throughout the day. It does not break from exhaustion. It rather breaks from invisibility.
How can we know their value better and admire and have the appreciation for their job? For her responsibility, even let's not call it a job.
Yeah, I would say act her one day. Be a mom one day. I would say, like, for example, if say to her one day that you stay aside, let me do your chores. I remember, like, when I was traveling somewhere and my husband did the chores, he told me the moment I was making the breakfast and the drop of oil suddenly stuck my skin. And I was burned. I was like, how do you manage to stay here for the whole day? So see, I would say, act her one day, be her one day. And the mothers themselves, I would say to them, do not let world define you by the title, by some title. You don't need that. You literally don't need that. Because angels record every crumb that you pick up in silence. You don't need the world to give you rewards.
Well, that was all the time we had for today's Muslim Lady. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. I invite you to listen to it. Muslim governors would use thin ultralight bird paper attached to birds to quickly send and receive messages across the empire. It was the email of the time. Islamic advances in the use of paper are the primary reason we read book rather than a scroll today. Now we'll listen to the continuation of the program on Iran Radio. Your presence truly enriches our broadcast. We're continuing with more outstanding programs this Monday, July 7th, and here's a glimpse of what's heading your way. For this hour, we are bringing you the news. Get informed with the top headlines and breaking stories from around the world. Then it's time for today's special, a special daily program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. This program makes extensive use of variety items such as Quranic verses, prayers, and nasheeds and reports. I'm hosting you in this program. Following that, we are diving into a collection of our finest radio productions. These are specially curated segments designed to entertain, educate, and inform, offering you a diverse range of engaging content. Then, Leader's Speech is coming up next. Listen to English translations of selected statements and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on various occasions, a source of profound wisdom indeed. Please stay with us. It's news time this hour.
Say, la ilaha This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Ukrainian president says Kyiv is open to drop its NATO membership bid as US and Ukrainian officials are to meet for a second day of talks in Berlin. And as people in Australia reel from the horror of Sunday's deadly shooting in Sydney, a Syrian-born Muslim bystander is being hailed for disarming by the attackers. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, I am Bahman Rayyan. A senior Hamas official has slammed Israel's frequent violations of the Gaza ceasefire agreement, which have claimed the lives of hundreds of Palestinian civilians so far. Osama Hamdan said Israel's truce violations have left more than 400 Palestinians, mostly women and children, dead since the agreement entered into force. He stressed that the movement reserves the right to respond to the occupation's violations. Hamdan noted that Hamas is in contact with the mediators regarding the negotiations for the second phase of the ceasefire, but the Israeli regime is doing its best to sabotage it. He also pointed to the deployment of an international force in Gaza. Hamdan said such a force must only act as guarantor for the implementation of the ceasefire agreement without any authority or contact with the Palestinian people in Gaza. He stressed that Palestinians uphold their internationally recognized right to resistance, especially armed resistance. The official said resistance is a purely Palestinian popular decision, not a decision of Hamas. Our correspondent Robert Inlakish joined us earlier.